It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Today, extinction. When my kids were little, it seemed like every picture book we read was full of animals. Night after night, we'd read stories about cuddly polar bears and naughty monkeys and whole oceans full of fish. And then I'd tuck them into bed with their favorite stuffed tigers and pandas. It's almost like there's a secret curriculum to childhood, to learn the Earth's creatures and fall in love with them. And maybe that's one reason it hurts so much to see so many of those creatures going extinct. The bad news is that Earth is facing a mass extinction crisis. By the end of the century, we could lose up to half of all living species. But the good news is there are people trying to do something about it, including trying to bring lost species like passenger pigeons and even woolly mammoths back to life.
Here's my prediction. Within the next couple of years, people working on this mammoth de-extinction project will succeed in transferring one, maybe two genes into an elephant cell that's growing on a dish in a lab. And they will be rightfully proud of this achievement. It will be a fantastic advance in this of this technology.
Beth Shapiro is a de-extinction biologist. And incredible as it sounds, she really is working on bringing the woolly mammoth back to life. In her lab at the University of California, Santa Cruz, she's isolating ancient mammoth DNA. But before you start thinking Jurassic Park, it's not exactly like that. Because the idea isn't really to clone a mammoth. It's more like breeding one.
It is more similar to breeding than cloning, only in that when people think about cloning, this word conjures up images of a specific scientific technique. Do you remember when Dolly the sheep was cloned? That is a technology that people think about when we think about cloning. That technology is called somatic cell nuclear transfer. The key to using this technology in de-extinction, however, is that you need to have a cell from an animal that's still alive in order for it to work. Because there are no mammoths presently alive, we can't use somatic cell nuclear transfer, this technology that people think of when they hear the word cloning, to bring back a mammoth.
So how is a mammoth going to come back? If it's not exactly the mammoth, what is it that people are working on?
People who are interested in de-extinction are not necessarily interested in bringing an exact replica of a species that used to be extinct back to life, but instead on bringing back or engineering an individual, maybe something different from anything that's alive today, that can somehow fit back into the place that these extinct animals once lived. When a species goes extinct, it disappears from a community of organisms that are all working together. And the disappearance or the extinction of that species kind of knocks that community out of whack. And what people interested in de-extinction aim to do is to fill those niches.
So for example,
an elephant is very different from a mammoth, but an elephant and a mammoth played very similar roles in their ecosystems. We could then replace what role the mammoth played in the Arctic ecosystem with a big herbivore that somehow is similar to a mammoth, but not identical.
So you're really not talking about resurrecting the mammoths. You're talking about creating a hairy elephant?
Yes, we're talking about looking at the mammoth genome and asking, what is it about the DNA sequence of the mammoth that allowed a mammoth to live in the Arctic? And so what we have to do is change the elephant genome just a little bit so that it can survive where a mammoth once did.
You also write about there's a Russian scientist who's actually so certain that somebody's going to come up with something like a mammoth that he's busy preparing a habitat for them?
Yes, Sergei Zimov. He's a really interesting guy who has purchased a lot of land around where he works in northeastern Siberia. And he is trying to create a habitat that mammoths can live in, but also that the species that are alive today that are kind of struggling to find sufficient habitat can live in. So right now he has several different species of deer, and he has bison that he's imported from Canada, and there are wild horses that are living there. And over the course of just a few years, they've transformed this landscape from a relatively barren tundra to a pretty rich and productive grassland.
Suppose somebody did bring back the woolly mammoth or something like it. A successful species is more than just biology, right? I mean, if this species hasn't existed before, how are the first new ones going to learn how and what to eat or how to survive?
It's a great question, and it's a question that needs to be considered when a species is being considered for de-extinction. You have this first phase where you manipulate a genome or you edit a genome and you change it so that you have an individual whose genome sequence looks like the way you want it to look. Then what comes next? That individual has to be born, has to learn how to act like a mammoth, if that's what you want it to act like. If that individual is born into a family of elephants, which it probably would be, isn't it just going to learn how to be an elephant? Probably. Is that enough? Well, it depends on whether being an elephant that can survive in the Arctic is enough to fill the niche that the mammoth once filled.
So is that the reason to do this? Not just to bring back a species, but to rescue or create an entire ecosystem?
I would say that that is the reason to do it. Not to bring back a species, but to restore missing interactions on an ecosystem that might actually help the species that are alive today.
You're one of the few people doing this kind of work, working with ancient DNA. What's it like in the lab?
Well, it's actually a big pain. Ancient DNA is basically, it just means DNA that's in terrible condition. The best preserved remains that we get are from the Arctic, which is why we've focused for such a long time on the big animals that used to live in the Arctic, like bison and horses and mammoth and woolly rhinos and things like that.
Have you actually gone hunting for mammoth bones, hoping to find some DNA?
Sure. I've been out both in Siberia several times, and I do most of my field work up in the Yukon Territory and in northern Alaska.
And what do you do in the lab?
What we do is we get the DNA in the form of the bone, and we take it back to the lab, and then we powder it up into a small powder, and then we incubate it with some chemicals that actually will break down all the bits of that bone that aren't DNA and wash it away, get the DNA out. And then we take that DNA and we sequence all of it. What we get back is a hard drive full of A's, G's, and T's broken down into smaller fragments. So the first task is to pull all that stuff apart and figure out what's mammoth and what isn't mammoth.
So besides figuring out how to bring extinct species back, there's also the issue of which ones. I mean, let's say you were on the President's Commission for De-Extinction, if there was such a thing, tasked with coming up with a short list of species to bring back. What would some of your top candidates be?
It's a fascinating question. And, you know, I taught a class here at UC Santa Cruz a few years ago where I asked all of my students to do that. Everybody seems to have a different reason for choosing different species. Some people choose species that are just fascinating, that are really different or weird or compelling for some reason. Other people just chose species because they thought they were cool, you know? Somebody want to bring a mammoth back to life because they want to ride one.
Well, I guess I thought that was the driving force behind the new science of de-extinction. I guess I thought that what everybody wanted was to see a living passenger pigeon again, or a living mammoth again, or any of the other things that have disappeared.
I think there are certainly people out there who would be excited to do that. And I am one of them. I mean, sure, if I could have the chance to see a mammoth, that would be amazing. And it would be incredible. And it would be scientifically fulfilling in some way. But I'm still not sure that that's good enough to justify the expense, both financial and ethical, of doing it.
It sounds like what you're saying is ethically, you have a real problem with the idea of one-offs. Let's create
ethically, yes,
a mammoth or a saber-toothed tiger or, you know,
yes,
a raptor, just so we can see what they used to look like.
Yes. Ethically, I have a problem with bringing a species that's extinct back just for the sake of looking at it and being happy that you've done it. I think if we are going to go through with de-extinction, we need to know why. There needs to be an ecologically compelling reason to bring them back, and we need to do it the right way. You can't bring back one mammoth. Elephants are highly social animals. Bringing back one mammoth is cruel.
So you'd that's have it. To bring back
a
what?
Whole population.
Wow. It would be a really beautiful thing to see mammoths roaming over the Arctic tundra, don't you think?
Absolutely.
Beth Shapiro is an ecologist and evolutionary biologist, and she works on ancient DNA in her lab at the University of California at Santa Cruz. She's also got a book due out this spring called How to Clone a Mammoth. Just in terms of the cool factor, resurrecting a woolly mammoth would be pretty hard to beat. But there are more urgent issues facing life on Earth. There's a major study that came out just the other day showing that many ocean animals are on the brink of disappearing. And now many scientists believe we're facing a new mass extinction, what they call the sixth extinction. That's also the title of a new book from Elizabeth Colbert. She's a science writer at The New Yorker, and she stopped by our studio recently to break some bad news to Steve Paulson.
Something like a quarter of all mammals right now are threatened with extinction.
A quarter of all mammals?
Yes. It's a very, very high number, a very scary number. And one thing that I think, you know, really makes an impression on people or should make an impression on people is all of our very closest relatives are threatened with extinction.
You're talking about the other primates?
Imminently. Well, I'm talking about the other great apes. I'm talking about orangutans, gorillas, chimps. I'm talking about bonobos. So those are our very closest relatives, and they are all endangered, in some cases, just hanging on.
But it goes way beyond that. I mean, the projections are what? A third of all sharks and rays likely to disappear? A fifth of all reptiles? A sixth of all birds?
Well, these are not just likely to disappear. I mean, these are already, you know, on the way to extinction. And the most, you know, threatened group of all right now is amphibians, actually. Something like 40% of amphibians are classified as in danger, and there's been a real spate of extinctions. There are just many, you know, fantastic frogs and toads that you cannot find anymore.
Now, tell me about one of those species of frogs.
Sure. Well, the species that I begin my book with, the species is called the Panamanian golden frog. It's actually technically a toad. And it's a very, very beautiful animal. It's a very bright yellow, the color of sort of a New York City taxi cab. It's very poisonous, and they communicate with each other. They live near running water, so they don't hear very well, and they don't have a call. Many frogs call, but instead they sort of wave. So anyway, they're extinct in the wild now. You can only find them in a couple of zoos and in this special facility that was built for them in Panama, because what happened was that people realized that there was this disease that was passing through the rainforest, passing through Panama.
And this was recent, right?
It was quite recent that this happened. This was back in 2006. And it took a long time to figure out what was happening to amphibians in Central America, because one of the very weird things is that amphibians were disappearing. People were going to places that are as untouched as a place can be in the world in the 21st century, and finding that frogs that they had been monitoring for, you know, years were suddenly gone.
And so this is not a case of humans clearing the rainforest and the amphibians disappearing.
Exactly. So there was a lot of controversy. There was a lot of head scratching. And eventually people figured out that a fungal disease was passing through, and you could watch that disease move. But what happened was, before they could build this facility, they started to notice that frogs were dying. And so literally, these frogs ended up being put up in a hotel.
The way you talk about this, it's almost as if the scientists who are dedicated to trying to save these species, they're setting up these little, what are the equivalent of Noah's Arks? You know, these little repositories of trying to get a few breeding animals that can carry on the species.
Yes, and more species. And I can go down a list of animals I have seen, you know, personally, that are one of, let's say, there's 100 left in the world, there's 200 left. And, you know, one of the questions that comes up in that, whether there's ever any possibility that they can repopulate the wild, is a very, very open question.
So we've already talked about the cause of at least a certain class of species that are going extinct, this fungus that is, that is wiping out a lot of frog populations, for instance. What are other causes of extinction?
Well, this fungal disease is emblematic of a bigger problem, which is that we're moving species around the world. So that fungus was probably moved around the world, you know, by people.
Inadvertently.
And now it's everywhere. And you hear about this all the time, right? You know, there are zebra mussels, there are Asian carp, all these things that could potentially wipe out native species. So that's one driver of extinction, bringing together things that are deadly for each other.
What about climate change? Is that having much of an impact on extinction rates?
Well, climate change is the big looming threat. We can certainly see a lot of species that are on the move. So if the climate's warming, you need to move either to a higher latitude or a higher elevation to try to, you know, keep in your climate mm-hmm. range.
Now, one of the revelations I had reading your book was the impact that climate change is having on oceans. I mean, with these greater levels of carbon dioxide, it's having a huge effect, especially on coral reefs.
Yeah, I think one of the great underreported stories of our time, really, to be frank, is what's happening to the oceans. And all you really need to understand this phenomenon is that when you pump a lot of CO2 into the air, as we're doing, a lot of it ends up very quickly getting dissolved in the upper layers of the ocean. And when CO2 dissolves in water, it forms an acid, carbonic acid. The ocean is becoming more acidified.
So what happens then to species in the ocean?
Any number of things could happen, right? The one that is pretty predictable, it becomes more difficult for any animal that builds a shell or an external skeleton out of calcium carbonate. So corals, any coral reef, all they're doing is, you know, assembling calcium carbonate. That is what a coral reef is. It's a lot of calcium carbonate. And there are very, very few scientists who say that, you know, if we continue to dump CO2 into the air and effectively into the water, that coral reefs will live out this century, okay?
Wow. You mean all the coral reefs in the world could disappear this century?
Yes. Yes. And I think people need really to be aware of that.
And a coral reef has one of the richest collections of biodiversity in the world, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's something called the rainforests of the oceans. And you know, I, in the process of reporting that book, I went to both a rainforest, mm-hmm. the Amazon rainforest, and to the Great Barrier Reef. And
in Australia.
Yeah. And I can tell you that the amount of life and the abundance of life and the diversity of life that you see on the Great Barrier Reef is really unequaled anywhere in the world. It is so extraordinary. You feel like you're in a dream landscape.
Tell me, I mean, you have this great description of what it was like to go there, and especially walking around at night on a little island on the Great Barrier Reef, which sounds like an amazing experience.
Yeah, I went to this little tiny island called One Tree Island, which it was just this bit of reef that had sort of been thrown up above the waterline by a big, big storm a couple thousand years ago. So the scientists I was with were doing an experiment that required you to walk out about a mile on the reef. You could only do it at low tide, otherwise you'd drown. And we would go out in the middle of the night. I would go out with them sometimes, and it was just a spectacular, sometimes rather hair-raising experience. And life, even in the pitch black, where you only have a flashlight beam in front of you, is extraordinary. You know, we would see octopuses and these amazing giant clams that live in the Great Barrier Reef.
You said you sort of had to, like, step over the clams, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, when I say giant, I mean giant. They're the size of not quite a bicycle tire, but very, very big.
Wow. So you were just walking along and seeing this whole incredible array of big animals below you.
Yes. And when you go out during, you know, we would go snorkeling sometimes when the scientists weren't working, when it was high tide. That is when you really see, you know, you just are looking down onto the reef and the assemblage of fish, just the extraordinary shapes and colors, and then followed by tuna, who are followed by sharks and rays, these incredibly very graceful, beautiful manta rays.
So did working in this project, writing this book, did this leave you really depressed?
It had two impacts simultaneously. To have more and more appreciation for the extraordinariness of life on Earth and the remarkable ways that so many different species have found to survive. And on the other hand, an extraordinary sadness. It's just in sort of unspeakable losses that's happening that will be definitely the most lasting legacy of humanity. Certainly, if we're going to do anything about it, we certainly need to be aware of it.
Elizabeth Colbert is a staff writer at The New Yorker. She talked with Steve about her book, The Sixth Extinction. Coming up, the story of the heroic quest to capture the first recording of one of the world's most elusive species, the ivory-billed woodpecker. Also, the story of how grizzly bears taught a traumatized Vietnam vet how to heal. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio, NPRI, Public Radio International. So there's a bird that's kind of a holy grail for hardcore birders, the ivory-billed woodpecker. Like the Loch Ness Monster, it's not even supposed to exist. It's been labeled extinct for 150 years, except every few decades, somebody spots one. And one sighting in 1932 launched an epic expedition to find, photograph, and capture the first ever recording of the rare bird. Greg Ely has the story.
It's 1935, and Jim Tanner is wading through a Louisiana swamp looking for an ivory-billed woodpecker. He's part of an expedition from the Cornell Ornithology Lab to record the calls of America's rare birds. And the ivory bill is the rarest. In fact, just a few years earlier, most people thought the country's largest woodpecker was extinct. So when a Louisiana legislator walked into the state game office and asked for a permit to shoot one, they humored him. A few days later, he triumphantly displayed his trophy, with a scarlet crest and white beak. It was a male ivory bill. Word spread quickly among birders, whose outrage at the kill was matched by their optimism. The ivory bill was still out there. At Cornell, they hatched a plan. The head of the lab, Doc Allen, convinced the American Museum of Natural History to fund the trip by promising to record a variety of bird calls. But the ivory bill was the main target. Paul Kellogg loaded a truck with 1,500 pounds of recording gear and microphones, many of which he designed himself. Jim Tanner, a promising grad student, went along to help out. He was 21 years old and kept a diary throughout the trip.
Wednesday, February 13th. Left Doc's house at 9:15 a.m. Paul and Mrs. Kellogg in a little rush. Doc and I in big. Good day for driving. Roads are clear and a nice sunset. Arrived in Washington at 9:30 p.m. Ambassador Hotel.
They head south toward the spot where the ivory bill had been shot. It's a plot of Louisiana forest owned by the Singer Company, whose plan is to one day turn the trees into sewing machine cabinets. The recording truck is too heavy for the swampy roads, so they unpack the gear and transfer it to a wooden cart. They enlist a local farmer and his two mules, who lead the cart toward the interior, where they hope the ivory bills are waiting. The first few days, nothing.
Friday, April 5th. Went out looking for ivory bills, but had no luck all day. We heard several turkeys gobble, slapped at many mosquitoes, felt a bit discouraged in the evening, but figured we would find them soon.
The very next day, with the men spread out across the swamp, they hear a female ivory bill and follow her calls to a large stump. There's a woodpecker hole in the middle.
Then the male suddenly appeared and flew into the nest hole. He clamped on the lower part of the nest hole with his feet. He looked around. His big white bill and white eye were in stark contrast to his black face. The crest was long and scarlet, and every one of us had his eyes glued on the bird.
There's laughter in camp that night, some of it at the expense of Paul Kellogg, who missed the sighting while he was working on the recording equipment. They found the bird, but they still needed what they came for. They needed to record it. 2 days later, after taking pictures of the birds and studying them in their habitat, they start moving the equipment toward the nest.
While we were resting the mules, I heard a kint south of the road and followed it. It called some more, and once I saw it fly, it sounded as though two birds were talking, and right near there we found a hole high in a tree. Without much trouble, we took the wagon in, and soon after that, Paul had the apparatus set up.
That was the first, and possibly the last, recording of an ivory-billed woodpecker. Those few days in Louisiana launched Tanner's life's work, defending the bird and its habitat. He went back to the swamp for the next 3 years to study the birds and wrote the definitive book on the ivory bill. He fought against the logging of those Louisiana woods and lost. Jim Tanner died in 1991, having last seen an ivory bill in 1939.
Craig Ely brought us that story. In the last 10 years, there have been two other reported sightings of an ivory-billed woodpecker, but despite extensive searches and surveillance, neither could be confirmed. So to date, the best documentation remains what Jim Tanner found back in the 1930s. One species that's not on the endangered list is grizzly bears, but their habitats are shrinking. And 40 years ago, one man emerged as a kind of savior of grizzlies. His name is Doug Peacock, and in wilderness circles, he's a legend. He's a Vietnam vet who was so traumatized by the war that when he got back home, he couldn't handle daily life. So he escaped into the wilderness. And when he was camping out in Yellowstone, he had his first brush with a grizzly. It changed his life. In fact, over the past decades, grizzlies have become so deeply embedded into Peacock's life that he even dreams about them.
One of my types of dreams is there's a mother grizzly out there, and she's got a bear cub, but the other cub is my daughter, crawling along on all fours. But I'm worried about my daughter. Sometimes my grizzlies are not quite natural. They're just distorted just a bit, and they can take on the specter of legend and of fear. You know, the bear and I, we have a relationship. We're not talking, but, you know, I know when it's dangerous and when it's not dangerous.
Doug Peacock's a natural history buff, and he's puzzled over one of the great mysteries in the history of extinction. Why did the giant mammals that once roamed North America disappear some 10,000 years ago? We're talking about huge lions and mammoths, the saber-toothed tiger, and most fearsome of all, he told Steve Paulson, the giant short-faced bear.
This is an animal that averaged well over a ton. The bigger specimens measure 7 feet at the hip. Standing up would have been a 15-foot bear. And this bear is a pure carnivore.
You're talking about a bear that's twice as big as the grizzly of today.
Easily twice as big as grizzlies today. And that basically precluded humans hunting big game. Now, anybody coming out of the Arctic, you know, 30 or 15,000 years ago would have been a big game hunter. It's the only way you can survive an Arctic winter. But as they went south and they ran into especially the short-faced bear, they couldn't secure a kill. But the short-faced bear had a lot of company. We had lions on this continent that were the same genus as the African lion, but twice as big. Also, we had saber-tooths. We had an American cheetah that's twice as big as the African one.
You know, one thing that seems to have happened is once these ancient ancestors, these old humans, invented the Clovis spear point, everything changed. I mean, it was the revolutionary technology where suddenly they could bring down a mammoth, and they were dangerous at that point.
That's true. It's, you know, the first of a long line of iconic American inventions. You know, it was the fluted, deadly 6-inch Clovis spear point, you know, as beautiful and sleek as a Patriot missile. We know nothing of these people except their material culture, pretty much. They seem to show up everywhere. Within 100 years, you find this iconic mammoth hunting projectile point from New York to Panama, from Washington State to Florida. And within a period of 300 years, the Clovis people and the animals they hunted, the great megafauna of the late Pleistocene, went extinct and were gone.
And that's one of the greatest mysteries in human history.
Truly,
is. In this relatively short period, all of these huge beasts that you were describing, they were all gone in a fairly short period of time. And that time seemed to correspond to when the Clovis people were around.
That's exactly true. And at the same time, we had our global warming that started about 14.7 thousand years ago. And that, no doubt, started to fragment habitats. You know?
Well, I mean, you're raising two possibilities as to what may have caused all of these huge animals to go extinct.
Maybe it was
global warming at that point, you know, the earlier version of global warming, or maybe these ancient humans hunted them into extinction.
I don't think either one quite stands up by itself. Human beings certainly didn't kill off all of those animals when Clovis showed up, because those animals were on the decline and moving around a lot, 14,000 years ago. The habitat is being fragmented, but it really very much looks like the coup de grace was hunting by humans and probably the Clovis hunters.
Doug, I know one of the reasons why you're so fascinated by this history is you have been for decades kind of entranced by what it's like to live alongside a top predator. I mean, for you, it's been the grizzly bear. You've lived among them for decades now. And you have said that the psychic landscape changes once you are in their presence. Once you're in the presence of an animal that could easily kill you if it so chose to.
It does transform the psychic landscape like nothing else can. You know, you take your Kelty pack and you hike in the High Sierras or anywhere in Colorado, and you're top dog, you walk down the trail, and you can be thinking about your girlfriend or your portfolio or something else, but, you know, you added a grizzly bear to that equation, and all of a sudden you're in grizzly country, you're not the top of the food chain, and you necessarily start looking around, and you smell better, you hear better. And, you know, I don't use trails. I've been chasing grizzlies now, well, it's 45 years or a little more. And I also fight to protect them, too, because in a way they saved my life when I came back from Vietnam, because what I needed after two tours as a Green Beret medic in Vietnam was to get out of myself. You know, the last thing I needed was self-indulgence. And when you enter grizzly country, where you're living with an animal that if it chooses could kill and eat you anytime it wants to, self-indulgence is just utterly impossible.
Well, and to put this in context, you just come back from Vietnam, you were a Green Beret medic. You were pretty shattered, weren't you, by what you saw?
I was there through the Tet Offensive, and the short story is I was responsible for, handled, and saw too many dead children. It was too much at the end. You know, I had gone sort of native by then in Vietnam, and the command knew it. They ordered me out of the field, choppered me out. I was way up in the Central Highlands in Quang Nai Province. We flew out to the coast. On my last day in the field in Vietnam, we got shot at, which is no big deal. You get shot at in a helicopter all the time. But I looked at the map, and I said, oh, yeah, I know this place. I've been on the ground there. It was My Lai.
But flew over during the My Lai Massacre?
Well, it was happening March 16th, the morning of March 16th, 1968. A year later, I saw those pictures in Life magazine. Those pictures changed my life forever. You know, I was never going to be a candidate for reentering society, and I haven't yet.
So you landed back in America. You landed out in the woods, in the wilderness.
I camped out for several years, literally, truly.
Why was that so healing for you, that experience?
Basically, it was because of the grizzlies. I couldn't be around people. The one place I've always been comfortable in my life is in wilderness. You know, I was raised that way. And so, you know, I found myself camping out in the Rocky Mountains. And so one day, I'm in this little tiny hot creek, which isn't very big. But here I am soaking in this hot spring in Yellowstone after the war. I look off to the side. Across the meadow, about 200 feet away, was a mother grizzly and two yearlings. I didn't know anything about grizzlies then, except you weren't supposed to be around mothers with cubs. So I decided I was going to climb a tree. So she turned, and I stood up, and, you know, the whirlpool-like effect on my brain, all the hot water caused me to black out. But I was terrified, and so I grabbed this tree head-on, bashed it with my head, cut a huge gash in my forehead. Blood's pouring down my eyes, but I'm still so scared. I climb up to the top of this lodgepole pine tree, and it's cold. It's 40 degrees, and it's October, and the wind is blowing like hell. And I get to the top of this tree, and I find out that it's not much bigger than a Christmas tree. So anyway, this mother grizzly and her two-yearling, they graze in the area for 40 minutes. They come within 20 feet of me. They never look up. They know I'm there. They just ignore me. And I'm sitting up there like some kind of silly bird, you know, blue from cold, bleeding. Those bears got my attention. They got my attention.
They did more than that. They changed your life, it sounds like.
Well, they did. They did because I'm a critic of our society. And that's what I think a writer has to be. And I inherited that from my old friend and mentor, Edward Abbey. And, you know, the easiest exit from culture is wilderness. You go up in wilderness, and after 3 or 4 days, something happens, and you're free of culture. And you're able to look back upon your own kind and your own ways with an objective mind, you know, that's free of judgment. You know, you add a grizzly bear to that occasion, and that's what allowed me to, you know, regather the elements of my own humanity. You know, those grizzly bears saved my life. I wouldn't have had children if I hadn't been, you know, humanized in a bit by having to watch the great grizzly. And the great lessons of grizzly bears are actually lessons of tolerance, lessons of restraint, and above all, in its enforced humility.
Grizzlies are also pretty dangerous. I mean, did you have any close encounters?
Oh, yeah. I've been charged over 30 times, almost always mothers with cubs. It was always my fault. During the day when it's hot, grizzlies sleep on day beds, and they really sack out. So you can get closer than you want to be to a mother grizzly. And in the early days, I wasn't quite as astute at discerning where these day beds were going to be, and I got too close a number of times. When a grizzly's charging me, I turn my head off to the side, because that's what bears do to one another. And I hold my arms out, and I'll talk gently. And I don't think it matters what you say so much as how you say it. And I don't move a muscle. And one of those mother grizzlies charged all the way, and about 6 feet away, skidded on her heels. She came so close to me, she leaned forward and sniffed my pant leg. And then after about 3 seconds, maybe four, it seemed like an eternity, but it wasn't very long. She just turned around, spun, and ran off, you know. So that's happened. It's happened a lot of times to me. And
were you terrified?
Not during those moments. A fear of bears is healthy. But I have bear dreams all the time. And my guess is that I work out my fear of grizzlies in my dreams. And when I'm out in the ground, fear doesn't happen to me. You know, I understand bears. I have relationships with a few individual grizzlies. There are dangerous bears, and I'm very careful around them. You really got to pay attention.
That's Doug Peacock talking with Steve Paulson. He's the author of Grizzly Years and In the Shadow of the Sabretooth. He was the inspiration for the character Hayduke in Edward Abbey's eco-classic, The Monkey Wrench Gang. You can hear him talk about their friendship and about the grizzly he calls his Moby Dick Bear in the uncut interview, which you can find on our website at ttbook.org. So this wraps up our discussion about wilderness and extinction. But coming up, in the aftermath of recent terrorist attacks in Paris, we'll talk about why hip-hop has become the music of angry French Muslims. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now, bookmarks, writers on books they love.
Hi, I'm Bob Mankoff, cartoon editor of The New Yorker magazine. And the book I'm going to recommend has zero cartoons in it, and really nothing funny either. The book is E.O. Wilson's The Meaning of Human Existence. I mean, how can you resist a title like that? E.O. Wilson, of course, has written a famous book on sociobiology. He's talking about our biological roots. Of course, he dealt with insects. But now he's talking about people. And he's talking about how if we want to know who we are, we have to know more than history as it's known now. History as it's known now is a tiny slice of our existence. Written history is what? 5,000-6,000 years. Our history is hundreds of thousands of years, and it's our evolutionary history. And for me, the most important thing in the book was the idea of how evolution works on groups, not just on individuals or genes. And I'm sure I'm misrepresenting what he says somewhat because I didn't understand what he said completely. But this is how I understood it, that one of the things you wonder about is something like altruism. Since it's survival, everyone is fighting for survival, why should you ever be altruistic? Why should you ever help somebody else? Well, it turns out that evolution is working on a higher level. It's working on groups. And as it works on groups, it's an advantage for a group. One group to have altruistic individuals will outcompete another group that has no altruistic individuals. So that leads to altruism, which is great. But what it also leads is to no altruism for the other group, and dislike for the other group, and even hatred for the other group. And the problem for human existence going forward is, how do we see ourselves as one group when we're fighting against this evolutionary baggage that we see every day in political parties and in sex and in all of the divisions? So for the meaning of human existence to have real transcendent meaning, we have to move beyond this. And that's what I found very moving about E.O. Wilson's The Meaning of Human Existence.
Bob Mankoff recommends The Meaning of Human Existence by E.O. Wilson. You'll find more bookmarks and an interview with Mankoff on our website at ttbook.org. And here's something that's on our minds.
Medine, don't panic. Muslim, je le suis every day.
So this is the French Muslim hip-hop group Medine with their hit song Don't Panic, I'm Islamic. As you can hear, it's an angry song. And there is a lot of angry Muslim hip-hop in Europe right now. Cultural critic Isham Aidi calls it rebel music. And he tells Charles Monroe Kane that the recent terrorist attacks in Paris have raised a lot of questions about the role of hip-hop among French Muslims.
Don't panic, voici mon slogan. Sortez les cuirasses et renfilez les gants. Tous les jours, au centre de la cible. Car tous les jours, je suis muslim.
What's ironic is these attacks have brought some unwelcome attention to the hip-hop community and hip-hop culture in France. The main reason being that the younger brother, Sherif Kouachi, who committed these acts, was actually an aspiring hip-hopper. And there's a documentary online where he's shown on stage, you know, wearing a cap backwards, Ray-Bans, rapping, dancing, and he's quite good, right? And so the argument now is, was he radicalized through hip-hop? This happens all the time. You get this argument often, right? Did he come to extremism through music and so on? So that's one part of the debate that's taking place around hip-hop in France. Another one is that a number of French artists, right, rap artists, very prominent rap artists, have come out and very directly and openly denounced the attacks on Charlie Hebdo. But as a number of journalists have noted, this is quite awkward because hip-hop artists did not like Charlie Hebdo. For the same reason that other minorities had an issue with Charlie Hebdo, they saw them as promoting hate speech and hiding behind free speech. What a number of hip-hop artists are saying is that is over the last 10, 15 years, the French government has taken a number of hip-hop acts to court, sued a number of hip-hop acts. Sarkozy, when he was Minister of Interior, would sue the group La Rumeur. Why? Because one of their artists wrote an essay that he included in a CD about police brutality and impunity of the French police, and Sarkozy was not having it, and he sued them. So a number of French groups have been sued for inciting hatred against the police, for inciting the Republic. Yesterday, in fact, a rapper by the name of Saïdou went on trial in France. He stood before a judge in Paris, sued by a right-wing group called the Agrif, who were sort of nostalgic for the colonial days, for when Algeria was under French colonial rule. Mm-hmm. You know, he's being sued for insulting the French nation. And what he said in his lyrics is, F France in her colonial past, right? So French artists, French hip-hop artists are often, you know, sued and censored and silenced. And in fact, a law was passed in the mid-90s to restrict the kind of hip-hop that was played on French airwaves and so on.
Car ils n'ont jamais vu le danger de près.
You know, it's not that much stronger. It's actually not as strong as a lot of gangster rap and hip-hop that I listen to from the United States, and certainly stuff from the 90s. I'm talking like N.W.A.'s F the Police and Ice-T's Cop Killer, things I think you would go to jail for in France if you wrote them. I'm thinking like Supreme NTM, the band, where they're having problems with having lyrics against the police that aren't even close to as strong as lyrics we have in the U.S. I guess I had forgotten that freedom of speech is at different levels in Europe than it does in America.
Yeah, well, Supreme NTM, in 93, they got into trouble for a track called Finger on the Trigger, I believe. And then in 95, on stage, they were accused of inciting violence against the police and calling the cops pigs and so on. And they got into they were fined for that and so on. But yes, free speech laws in France are more restrictive. And hip-hop artists have gotten into trouble in France a lot more than in the U.S. The only time I can remember in the U.S. where the government stepped to regulate or to ban an album, very briefly actually, was 2 Live Crew in the early 90s.
I remember that.
But that was a local judge, you know, in Florida, and the decision was overturned. So, you know, in the U.S. there's no Ministry of Culture. The government doesn't really regulate culture. That's left to the private sector to shape tastes and consumption habits and so on.
I'm listening to this music and I'm hearing the samples from the DJ and I'm recognizing the samples. Now, I was waiting for a lot of Tupac, Biggie imagery in here, but I wasn't getting that. I got a lot of things that I picked up from looking at this about Malcolm X, about the Black Panthers, that really surprised me that was what the imagery was coming from.
There's a great deal of interest in the Black experience and the African-American experience in France. There's a long history to this. One of the reasons is that there was an expat community that appeared in France right after World War II. And, you know, you had writers, African-American authors, people like James Baldwin settling in France. Then you had jazz artists and the Harlem Renaissance, which used to go back to the 20s. The Harlem Renaissance would, in effect, play out in France. Right? You had this expat, you had these trends and fashions, you know, reaching France. And then from there, it percolate downwards to North Africa and West Africa. So there has been a long, a deep interest in that. And the great irony, France always supported the African-American struggle and welcomed African-American artists, critics, radicals, wanted to settle in France, making the argument that France was actually immune to any kind of American-style racism. So one of the reasons that France celebrated Black American culture was it saw itself as different, right, as not having the racial issues of America. And for instance, when Woodrow Wilson screened Birth of a Nation, the French made it a point to not show the film because it was racist. Fast forward 60, 70 years later, by the late 80s, early 90s, you begin to get this emergence of an African-American inspired culture in France. And by this time, it's actually the children of immigrants, North Africans, West Africans, Caribbean immigrants, who are embracing the language of Black Power and hip hop and the civil rights movement to critique the French system. Just yesterday, Manuel Valls, the French politician, came out and gave an interview where he said, you know, in France today, we have an apartheid society.
Wow.
And he spoke of ghettos. He says, in France, we have territorial, ethnic, spatial apartheid, and we have not paid attention to the urban periphery and to the ghettos. Now, then the fact that he used the word apartheid and the fact that he used the word ghetto is very significant. It's on the front page of Le Monde today and essentially confirmed the language in the critiques that the rappers make of there being ghettos in France. Elle verra s'envoler l'illusion qu'elle se fait d'elle-même. Je suis pas en manque d'affection, comprends, je n'attends plus qu'elle-même. Yes, there's hardcore rap in Western Europe, but there's a strain of Sufi Muslim hip-hop music.
Tell us how that grew out of this.
What I find interesting is how over the last decade, at least, governments have tried to promote sort of the more mystical variant, as they call it, the Sufi hip-hop artists, to counter the more hardline Islamist or else just more left-wing artists. The prime example is Abdel Malik in France. Abdel Malik, you know, French Congolese, he comes out of the city of Strasbourg. As, you know, as a youngster, he dabbled sort of in petty crime. And then he became a rapper. He achieved some notoriety with the New African Poets. And then he became sort of, he left hip-hop and he left the Islamism and became a Sufi spoken word artist. And when he became a Sufi spoken word artist, he puts forth sort of a Sufi universalism, right? His argument is that Islam is entirely compatible with the French Republic's values. There's no contradiction between Islam and French values and French secularism, right? Mm-hmm. Abdelmalik, as soon as he started doing the spoken word poetry, the French cultural establishment embraced him. They see the kind of Islam that Abdelmalik represents as a kind of Islam they want in the public arena in France, right? Sort of a Sufi Islam, soft, not confrontational, not putting forth the critiques that these other hip-hop artists put forth. He's an incredibly talented artist, right? However, once the French cultural establishment embraced him, he began to lose the base. He began to lose the street. He came to be seen as a top-down artist. So there's a debate now, you know, in France about, I mean, if the, you know, the cultural establishment, the government, too, there's a Ministry of Culture in France that actually actively supports different groups and so on. And you have government officials talking about what kind of hip-hop is best conducive for integration, can help best integrate these communities, these minority communities, into the French mainstream. So they're trying to identify a good moderate hip-hop. Now, if you're a hip-hop artist, the moderate label is, you hear this often in discussions of Muslim-majority states and of Muslim minorities in Europe, is the moderate label is a top-down racial label, right? It simply means that the establishment, the state, the government, the majority sees you as compliant and well-heeled, right? So it's not a label that you want. If you're an artist or an activist or an up-and-coming leader, you don't necessarily want to be embraced, known as the moderate, right? It can separate you from the base. It can separate you from your own community.
Isham Aidi is the author of Rebel Music, Race, Empire, and the New Muslim Youth Culture. Charles Monroe Kane talked with him. Oh, and hey, Aidi put together an extensive video playlist of European Muslim hip-hop. You'll check it out on our website at ttbook.org. That's it for this hour, but if you'd like to comment on anything you heard, talk to us on Facebook. And if you like To the Best of Our Knowledge, we're growing our podcast, so subscribe. We put a big purple button on our homepage, so just go there and click it. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced in Madison at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson, with help from Charles Monroe Kane, Raymond Tangakar, Doug Gordon, Craig Ely, and Sarah Nix. Our technical director is Kirill Owen, theme music by Steve Mullen from WalkWest Music. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.